Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming out. We're going to get started. And how many boomers are there in the room? Okay, thank God. And you're very brave because the title of this session, Big Old Babies and How the Boomers Have Failed When It Comes to Public Media, is appropriately provocative and, speaking as a boomer, pretty darn accurate. If you're going to tweet, there you go. Easy. So, good morning. I'm Vivian Schiller. I'm sorry Juan Williams couldn't make it this morning. He's otherwise occupied. I'm the person who rebranded NPR and removed the name radio from the title. And I'm sorry I couldn't be here, but Vivian got sick. And so my name is John Barth. I'm with PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and I volunteered to step in. I wish I had hair like that. You know, some people suggested I would need to visit a psychiatrist to do this panel. Provocative is hardly the word. And it was funny, when I was in the bar here last night, a number of general managers were coming up to me and saying, well, they were loaded for bear. And it says a lot about the issues that are going to be discussed this morning, because they're ones that are really central to not just public media, but challenges in the workspace. Because as a former generation begins handing off media to a new generation, there are a lot of tensions and there are a lot of challenges about who's going to control media going forward and how is it going to operate. And are we going to be able to live up to the promise of a broadcast medium making a transition to something much more dramatic and more complex and more promising than what we built? Just to speak for baby boomers, you know, public media existed and became in creation on our watch. So that's a lot to be proud of. But the fact of the matter is, if you work in an operation where you do have a lot of millennials or Gen Xers taking more important roles and having more effect in your organization, you know, you can't just like sit back and talk how great it was to create the Diane Rehm Show. So I wanted to kind of frame this discussion in a few different ways. We're going to be talking a little bit about the clash of work cultures, you know, the environment that, you know, we see emerging is a much more collaborative one, one where teams and individuals work much more closely together, many times in common spaces, as opposed to what we as baby boomers really grew up with, which were very strict hierarchical processes, career ladders. So you paid your dues and you put in your time, and maybe after 15 years you would get a change in title and a little bit more responsibility. Just moving from a very highly structured, defined, and rather authoritarian work process to one that has more been shaped by the processes that go into making software and now creating what's coming with new media. The other thing we're going to look at here, of course, is the generational clash. And you know, when I was looking around for images last night, and I found that one of the very hearty, healthy boomers jogging out there, I mean, it was embarrassing because I thought, well, these look like a lot of my friends. And it's a little scary because my friends start to look like my parents. And that's a really scary thought. But on the other side of this is that, you know, we come out of a generational experience that was shaped by a lot of very, very traditional forces, most of them coming out of the post-war years. And so there are things that we can't remove ourselves from, whereas the Gen X and millennial generations are shaped by an entirely different set of factors. And I would really recommend that you find this article in the Harvard Business Review, The Next 20 Years, How Customer and Workforce Attitudes Will Evolve. Neil Howe and William Strauss are two pretty amazing demographers. They do a lot of work on changing generational habits. And what they've done in their work is they've looked back over 100 years and been able to discern patterns and commonalities in generations that get repeated in cycles. So those of us of the boomer generation, I think they identify as the profit generation. Profit generation also came out after the Civil War. And so our core values are really, it's funny. If you look at the, public radio statements that Jake Shapiro talked about yesterday, where there's a set of core values to public radio, completely in line with a post-war generation of boomers. We think and talk about values constantly. The millennial generation, that is not what they talk about. They're part of another cohort, and their values are very different, and what motivates them is different. And what I really like about this research is this graph alone kind of like symbolizes some of the stuff that we see in workplaces and why, certainly in public media, resistance to change is so challenging. Boomers' resistance to the Gen X lifestyle will become more pronounced. And we're seeing that in a lot of workplaces. And boomers will try to impress younger Americans more by who they are than by what they do. And if you've spent time with the millennial or Gen X workers, the challenge there is that they really don't care what we've done or what our position is or what our title is. It's like, what are you doing now? It's much more reflective of a maker culture as opposed to one that's defined by hierarchy and position, which is humbling as your hair thins out or you get grayer. This is an image. I don't know if you saw the story this week about women in at NPR, but I love this image because, NPR and public radio was largely born in the 70s, and look at the attitudes on these faces. It tells you a lot, too, because they were redesigning media for another generation, and I don't know about you, but I've seen that look a million times, mostly because I've caused it. So I'd like to introduce the panelists. Adam Schweigert is with used to be with WOSU in Columbus, Ohio, and he and I got to know each other pretty well because he also worked at Indiana Public Media in Bloomington. And everybody up here has been in public media and left because of a variety of factors. But a lot of them having to do with the frustration that they face. So Adam, now you work for a design firm in Columbus, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Mindset Digital. Yeah.
Great. Dee Kapila used to work at KUT here in Austin. She'd done a lot of work with web design and web process, interactivity. And Dee, you now work for?
I work for the University of Texas.
The University of Texas, right. Jonathan Kaufman, he and I share a bit of a background. We both went to the University of Missouri J School, but he worked at PBS headquarters in D.C. And was really instrumental on their social media team, major accomplishments in terms of interactivity there and how to advance social media. But Jonathan left, and Jonathan is now working at Dell here in Austin. So, Jonathan, why don't you get started, and let's talk about what are the 10 things that are really on your mind and bugging you?
Absolutely. So we've, the panelists have identified 10 key things that we're going to walk you through today that we think are tremendous opportunities to help grow and evolve, the workplace as well as the product of public media. And, the first one here is it's not all about you, and it's certainly not all about us either, right? What we're doing here is we're trying to focus on a user-centered approach. And as people who have worked on the web and grew up with the web, we're looking at these opportunities across different platforms, right? So the interactivity is evolving from the broadcast model, right, to two-way conversations across the board. And that's what we're looking for in the workplace as well. I think it's apt that this is one of the first points, right, because we're not, trying to be adversarial, like John said, we're all former public media employees, but we care enough, right, to come back and try to help push along the dialogue, right? And so seeing as how we don't control our audience's experiences as much as we used to anymore, I think it's important to realize that we also don't have as much control over the workplace as we used to, right? As these different generations evolve, and as new and fresh faces come into the media, right, we're creating these new experiences that are like the image of the folks working in radio in the 60s and 70s, right, as just continue to evolve and explode across the country. We're looking at the explosion of the web and all of these technology workers who I think we've identified a few themes that are vitally important to the way, at least in our opinions, things should evolve and move on.
Can I ask you a question? So your general experience has been when you work with boomers in public media, they're focused more on the brand or marketing side as opposed to the audience side. Is that?
Absolutely, and that's a big part of this, right? So public media, NPR, PBS, and all these stations rely so heavily on their brand and all of the, trust and, recognition of those brands. And now, I think we see a continued evolution of, taking those brands and extending them onto these new platforms. And, you have to maintain your core values of these brands and experiences, but at the same time, you have to be open to having these conversations with your audience, with your employees, and building these out. And I think that you'll notice throughout the panel that these dynamics aren't necessarily new, right? They're evolving. They're largely cyclical, and that's where we're going.
So the second point that is kind of one of the challenges that we're seeing in public media, and certainly across industries as well, is this idea of iterative versus ongoing. Particularly, I'm going to bring up the sort of redesign process when it comes to digital products. I feel like a lot of the challenges that the millennial generation sees is, when is this redesign going to be finished? When are we done with this? When can we ship it? When can we roll out the press release? Have the big party, all that kind of thing. When really with these types of products, particularly in digital, this needs to be more agile. We need to have sort of scaffolding phases. I think we talked about this a little bit, where you say, okay, what milestone are we hitting here? And then at that point, what are we doing for the second one and the third one? And it needs to keep going. I mean, if we're really going to be successful in the digital space, we're going to be making all of these mistakes. And we're going to need to be able to be fluid enough to come back and change the things that we've already done. And going back to kind of our first point, it's not about you, with digital, you've got to see after you've done something. I mean, hopefully you've done research before, but after you launch something, you need to see how your audience even responds to it. Because if they don't, well, the relaunch didn't really happen. We got to go back and redesign again. So I think that's kind of the main...
But D, isn't it done? Like, haven't you finished yet?
Is this
a product? Isn't this a product?
Right. And I think that's kind of the conversation that needs to be had. I think, coming from particularly the technical point or the technical position in a technical role, I think that's definitely the way that we think. We think intangible, you're looking at code, you're looking at systems. There is a point where things need to be done at a certain, to sort of, I guess, get paid. But a lot of this conversation has to be had that, there's a lot more your tech staff is going to be doing after you launch this, and I think a lot of times, too, sort of those functions are looked at as almost like janitorial, where it's like, hey, we messed up, where are you guys, let's fix this, and that's not necessarily the type of development I'm talking about either. Yes, there's going to be issues in tech support after that, but there's, yes, let's launch, yes, let's have a launch party, yes, let's say we're done, yes, let's send out that press release, but let's talk about the other things we're going to do, let's continue to survey our users, and let's see what they tell us.
So do you think that there's a sense that boomers in this environment see projects as off a checklist, and once I've checked it, we're not going back?
I do, and I think, I think with redesigns, when you talk about things like logos and you talk about, taglines, those can be finished. And so when you roll those into some of these digital redesigns as well, I think it kind of becomes, well the tagline's done, the logo's done. What's up with the website? Why isn't that? What's up with the app? And why are we already talking about the second version? I think there's kind of, we need to talk about the second version.
Great.
So we all go to a lot of meetings, right? And this is really kind of universal. I think boomers and and I think like millennials can probably agree on this one, that especially as, I mean, like a lot of things are actually moving on like a lot faster, right? We have to make like decisions faster. We have to be more, I think like decisive. That, you know, it's like a lot of like standing meetings every week, hour long, you know, to kind of touch base, you know, and make, you know, like a lot of like decisions by like committee is, I think, slowing us down. I think millennials, I mean, Jake especially, value like a lot of like flexibility. So we like, you know, to say, you know, it's really, is there like a point like for this meeting? Are we making like a decision here? Is there, you know, is there actually like something action oriented coming out of this? And if not, you know, is it something that like, we can do by, you know, email instead? Are there other, you know, other sorts of tools we can use so that we use meeting, you know, it's meeting time like productively to either brainstorm or to actually make like a decision and to not just kind of, you know, air our, you know, as views and kind of do all of like that kind of stuff to kind of, so to, you know, let's figure out how to actually minimize that and to actually like become, you know, more of like a culture of makers rather than, you know, rather than like spending a lot of time in like a lot of meetings.
Does this sound familiar to a lot of boomers and the other and also millennials? Yeah. Yeah. In fact, at PRX, what we did is we stopped all staff weekly update meetings, and I've actually consolidated that process into a much smaller and faster kind of gathering, and rely tremendously on wikis and other shared spaces in order to move along things and share information, but not in a way that would, you know, waste a lot of time. So, and you use the word individual as opposed to group, and I, that just really struck me as something really strong. That's something that you identify with. The other one is productive time. You mentioned that.
Yeah. I mean, I think especially, you know, it's like a lot of us are in like sort of like technical areas, you know, it's having like a large like block of, you know, uninterrupted time to sort of crank, you know, to just like crank away on some code or something is like something that if we have like meetings all the time, you know, kind of breaks up our just kind of day, you know, into chunks where maybe we have half an hour in between like meetings and all I can do is answer some email, right? So to really figure out how to actually build a culture like where we can have, you know, it's that kind of time, I think is important as well too, especially for you know, certain areas, especially, you know, sort of technical and I think creative folks.
Right. So as a boomer, when we talked about this, this really had strong resonance for me, and I remember great frustration in terms of, well, when do we catch up? How do we know what's going on? And then you realize, oh, I think that way because I'm a manager, and managers aren't really necessarily always the doers. We're managing a process, but we're not building directly. And sometimes we use the meetings as a way to get comfortable, right? So I found this one to be really, really resonant. And you should grab these three afterwards because I think this is a key one.
So this one I'm actually going to say is something that we did that's really bad. And by we, I mean the millennials. You know, we decided when we started getting a little bit of attention from our managers, like let's wow them, let's razzle-dazzle them with this catchphrase. And we started tossing around in the last year or two this idea of failure and how amazing it is and how we should be allowed to fail. And so then we went and we glamorized failure, and then what happened? Nothing, really. Or, in many cases, what had happened was to a deterioration of quality control, particularly with your digital products. This sort of idea that, hey, you want to try stuff? Go ahead, try stuff. And now you're not sleeping because you're too busy trying to make this stuff go. You know, I think this is a 30 Rock reference that I love. Shut it down. You know, there's all of these projects that you're going to start, you're going to be trying to do, almost to make a point at some times about succeeding digitally. And if they're failing, you need to kill them. And I think the other thing, too, is you need to let your... You need to set that expectation, you know, need to manage up and let your managers know, yes, I want to be able to experiment, but let's do some metrics. And what I've seen happen when you have that conversation is there are metrics in some places and metrics not in others. So there are projects that management will say, wow, this is actually great. I love this. This is awesome. And this worked really well in our pledge drive, so let's keep doing that. But we're not measuring that anymore because it's become a pet project. And it may need to be killed because maybe it's not successful. And so I think what's kind of happened is that the millennials have glamorized failure, again, to reiterate. And there's not QC to measure all of these projects that we're experimenting with. And so at the end, we really haven't done anything except added more to our workload and sort of deteriorated the overall digital product. So I think that's a really important thing to think about, is that, you know, that you're not just innovating for innovation's sake and that everything that you're doing has a measured outcome. And, you know, I'd like to ask the boomers to do that, as my boss, measure what I'm doing. And then as Adam's boss, measure what he's doing. But don't just measure his and let me get away with whatever I want because it worked once really well for Pledge. You know, that kind of thing.
And also try to understand, I think, you know, if we say, you know, that this got 40,000 hits, right? You know, is that a lot? Is that good? You know, is that bad? You know, so ask us, you know, it's to actually explain more, I mean, Jake, about like what that means and to actually provide, you know, its context for you. You know, it's because I think that's actually, you know, it's like a really important thing is, you know, you got numbers, I got numbers, you know, we all got numbers and we need, you know, to actually like use them to make like decisions, but, you know, with like a lot of like context around them. So to actually figure out like what all of this means, I think is really important too.
So as a boomer manager, how this whole area is new to me. I barely understand what you're telling me that you're going to build. How do I begin finding reliable metrics to even judge the work that you're going to put in front of me, which kind of pisses me off because you should be doing other stuff anyway.
Well, I think, you know, there's hardly going to be anything that we're going to be trying that in some way hasn't been done before by someone else. Not necessarily in public media, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, too, but maybe someone in another industry has done it. Let's look at it. There's metrics out there. And if there's not, we can make them up together. I think that that's the conversation. Those are the meetings we need to be having. You know, okay, we're going to do this project. This is how we're going to do it. And then how are we going to measure it? Let's set these metrics together. And then let's look at it. I mean, I don't want to work on stuff that's not doing well either, you know?
Great.
So, you know, inside of public media, if you're like a smaller like station, you look at a large like station. If you're like a large like station, you look at NPR or you, you know, look at other like larger like stations. I think, you know, in general, you know, as public media needs to really like look outside, especially to tech and actually journalism startups, to like learn how to do, I mean, like a lot with like a little, right? So to actually like figure out, you know, like how do we move, you know, it's faster, you know, and really like how do we form like meaningful, you know, as partnerships also too. So it's not just learning like from them, you know, it's, but also like figuring out how can we, you know, like work like better as a system and kind of together. So there's sort of two different things in here. There's kind of look outside and there's also to end all these, you know, as turf battles, right? Because public media, if we want to actually like survive, I think we need to have a shared mission and understanding and like not, you know, as compete like with each other. So to get over that and actually move like beyond to form like longer term, you know, it's meaningful partnerships, you know, it's between stations, between outside startups and nonprofits and also national organizations to really move everything forward.
Yeah, but you know, I don't know if I really want to work with that guy in Columbus, Ohio. You know, I got my own thing here to run, and you know, the last time I looked, you know, they didn't really hit their numbers either. So really, Adam, I'm going to be able to learn from them?
I think so. I mean, I think you can learn even if it's from, you know, from like looking at like something, and again, being like, critical about it and being like, did this work? You know, is it actually like a measurable outcome that I want to actually try to implement or not, right? And also finding like efficiency, I think, is really important too. Just because we all are actually like facing budget pressure, So I think the more that we can share things and the more that we can like collaborate, I think there's just like a tremendous amount of efficiency there too.
So those of you who work in public media know that the word collaboration is it's almost like eating dog food. It's like very unfamiliar to us. It's a very hard one for us to get around. And it's you know, to CPB's credit, they have put a lot of money and effort into projects that actually try to encourage stations and others to work together and even to reach out to other common institutions in their communities. But it's really been quite a struggle. And I think that certainly at the Boomer level, we look at issues of governance and structure. And are those getting in the way of the ability to better collaborate and better partner, not just with other stations or other groups, but other institutions in our community where we could all become much more effective? And it's really quite a challenge. And this is a message that I know that I hear an awful lot is, why can't we learn better from others, and what's the problem? And I don't know whether that's a Boomer issue or whether that's a structural or governance issue.
All right. So, on that same note in creating partnerships and working with outside folks, I think that it's also important to talk about the flip side of that, which is, working internally, working with the other stations and other public media organizations, right? And it's an area that I spent a lot of time thinking about and working on in my time in public media, right? And doing what I could to try to advance, the internal collaboration and help and trying to connect people and connect organizations. And there have been a lot of attempts over the year in public media, and I know there were probably at least a handful of sessions at the IMA conference earlier this week, and how to connect people. And they, on an individual level, people have been doing this forever, right? The engineer who calls, a buddy in another state to work through an issue, the, message boards and email lists over the years from tech people or engineers and now technologists, all the way to over the last few years, things like the Public Media Camp Unconferences, right, which is an attempt at bringing together face-to-face interaction between public media entities. And then even, the folks up here at the table running the weekly Twitter chats over the last couple of years. So there have been so many attempts at this, and I think it's a fundamental issue that I don't necessarily think is generational, but I think that there's a lot of effort and a lot of solutioning that needs to continue to happen.
Do you and mention to me before we started this about the value of mentors and guidance and preparing another generation for leadership? Without mentioning any names, give me an idea of like a great mentorship. So what have you experienced, and what are some of the characteristics of that you look for?
Sure. And I have to say that that's the number one thing that I look for in my career choice is somebody that's my boss or my boss's boss or whoever that I can look up to, that I can learn from, that can kind of mold me into being hopefully someday a leader of something. Who knows, right? And the relationships that I've found, and they're not necessarily in the same. They're not necessarily tech people that are above me. I've had people that know nothing about tech that are still my mentors that I talk to very regularly. And there's a couple of things about them that I love that I think also can be frustrating, but in a good way that challenge me. Number one is, they listen to my complaints and then they argue with me. And they tell me what they think I'm doing, what they think I'm saying is wrong, and then I argue back. And so we kind of have this conversation, and it's very, it's not kind of that employer-employee relationship that you have sort of formally. It's a lot more collaborative. It's not as combative, but it's much more honest. And that's what I think we need as people that are going to be leading when you give us the baton, if you give us the baton. And I think that's number one for me. Number two is, I want a leader that can admit what they know and what they don't know and can tell me what I know and what I don't know and where I need to move. And I think that's so important. And I think we're willing to hear that. I don't think that we just want to complain and tell boomers what they're doing wrong. I think we want some pushback. I mean, we like being told we're wrong. We'll argue with you until the day that we die, but,
But that's what we're looking for. I mean, we just really want to have that conversation that we can't have usually.
Right.
That's so a really big point, right? Because the processes are not necessarily set up for that right now. And I think that's one of the big takeaways, I hope, from this session is that, you know, all of these points cut both ways, right? It's whether it's, you know, a peer-to-peer mentorship, whether it's a leader and someone who wants to become a leader, right? It's the push and pull that is that sort of ties all of these various ideas together.
Right. So if you're a boomer manager, this has got to be one of the most familiar complaints you get. And speaking as a boomer manager who's had to manage a number of younger staffs, the first thing you're thinking about is mentor? What the heck is that? How much time do I have to spend? What? And I found looking
back. Is that another meeting I have to go to?
Right.
Well, exactly. For us. But the other one, too, is that I found in talking with other boomer managers that the challenge is that we actually don't know how to mentor. What is it that your expectations are about what we're going to be passing on? How does that process take place? So, and I love the way that you characterize this, that you'll argue with us to the day we die or the day we retire, right? And that's actually how boomers sometimes experience it. Oh, my God, I'm going to sit in this meeting with this younger person. It's just going to be complaint, complaint, complaint. As opposed to the way you're seeing it, which is a very, very valuable engagement and discussion, not around people, but it could be around process or product or service. And it's somehow getting to that point where you understand what's actually happening in the course of that discussion. But I found that so many boomer managers don't even want to engage on that level. It's like, you know, just do your work and, you know, we'll talk about it at your 12-month review, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Is that common? Is that a big issue? What, John?
Can I respond?
Well, you may, yeah.
Absolutely.
But it's not going to be a long meeting, okay? So go ahead.
You know how I feel about this. Should I use the mic?
Yeah, could you? Yeah.
First of all, I think this is a fantastic session. It really is. I've taken more notes at this session than any other one. I think as a boomer, many of us feel that what are we here for at this point except to grow you guys? And so rather than think of this as a task, it's more of just the opposite. This is our turn to pass things on and share and hear the pushback. So your characterization isn't necessarily one that I share, the eye roll. And I know you're just trying to make a point, but I think it's important to make the other point.
Anybody, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Case in point, my 85-year-old best friend. I don't think it's a boomer issue. I think it's a person issue. Who's always flexible, willing to change, let go, let something die so that something can be born. I love working with millennials. I hook up more with the people who are also at the same time, not just on these, but also, you know, out in the outdoors and experiencing life so that they're not living on the matrix, they're living in both worlds. I would also encourage everybody to check out Margaret Wheatley, W-H-E-A-T-L-E-Y. This is an issue between the Newtonian way of looking at things, where everything's black and white or step by step or mechanistic, and the new way of looking at things, which is much more chaos theory, things forming because of sort of organically, and it's very cool. And I love working with millennials. So
that's great. Yeah, and Margaret Wheatley has been writing about this for over 20 years. I mean, she's really a leader in terms of organizational change and just all these issues. But this is a big one, and you two and others here in this room may be a bit unusual, but in terms of I think our experiences in public media workplaces, the opposite is more common, that this tension, this friction, this lack of mentorship is a real issue. And it's one that really speaks directly to the threat facing our business, which is the need for new leaders prepared. So there's a tremendous amount of passion here to take control of public media. But we really set up the process that will make them fully formed and ready to do this. So they're not set up to fail.
Oh, this is my favorite. That was millennial sarcasm, just in case you missed it. So there's this concept of of tech in a box. And again, I'm bringing up tech because that's what I know. And it's this idea that, okay, we need to hire a position to be in our tech staff. Let's write this description. We need a webmaster. We need a content strategist for digital. We need desktop support, an engineer, multimedia producer, a web designer, a web developer, and to do social media, right? That's all in one position. And then you hire for that position and you expect that person to do all of those things. And I'm not really sure when it happened in the education system that people thought that you get a degree in tech and that means that you can do everything that technology has to offer. It's a huge field, huge, right? There's tons of things, it's very specialized. And I mean, I know particularly in development staffs, I mean, you've got people that are running your pledge drives, then you've got major, like, people that are responsible for major donors, for endowments. I mean, there's separate staff members handling different levels of giving. So why can't we look at our tech staff, you know, in that way? And I think that becomes a challenge. And I have to say, I think that's one of the reasons why we're so slow to move in digital. And it's not just because of the, I mean, although the opposition we face from boomers is one of the things for me. I think the other thing too is, even if we get the freedom to do it, there's a lot to do for that one person that was just given all of those tasks I just described. So we'll maybe get done in 5 years building a website, and by then no one's looking anymore, right? It's time for another redesign. So that's kind of, I think that's a really, really big thing, is to have a tech person that is just sort of a tech in a box. It's a catch-all for anything technology-wise that you would do. Oh, you know, can you set up my iPad? Oh, let's have a Tumblr. Hey, let's do a reading. You know, it's just, it's not sustainable. It's not realistic. It needs to stop.
And can you fix my printer?
Right.
I can't get it. Oh, I have this Excel problem.
Why are you
help me with my spreadsheet.
Like,
yeah, you know,
great.
You know, just because I'm young doesn't mean I can fix your printer.
Right. And I think there's also an assumption on a lot of boomers who hire that, oh, I've hired a young person. Well, they absolutely know how to do that Twitter thing, mm-hmm. right? And that's kind of a crazy bias too. So the expectations here are really challenging. And you know, Dee, you just raised something. So here I am. I'm running a public TV station. I have full programming engineering staffs for broadcast. I do have a whole machine of people with specialized skills to run the broadcast, everything coming out of that transmitter. But when it comes to the technology side, I'm looking for that one person, as you put it, in a box, who that's going to be my investment. See, I've checked that off. I'm mm-hmm. a boomer. I've got that done. I'm doing the digital, baby. I got 1.5 full-time equivalents working on this internet thing.
And I mean, and to be honest, like the people that you're going to hire on your tech staff are, you know, 9 out of 10 times going to be huge geeks and dorks. And we probably do spend a lot of time in dark rooms in our basements learning all of those different things anyway. But you know, I don't know anything about ham radio. You know, that's a totally different skill set for me. Boomers know about that. So there, you know, there's just kind of, I mean, it's a completely different, I think it's just a completely different idea of what you're expecting out of your one tech person to be able to do. It's not.
That's fair enough. Yeah, ask David Al. He knows about ham radio.
Well, yeah, and so did my technical manager.
Yeah, right, the big antenna in the backyard. It's always fun, yeah. Number 8.
All right. So as the saying goes, millennials expect the world to be handed to them on a silver platter. Whether that's true or not, you know, a lot of us tend to be impatient. Right. And we're going to get discouraged if we don't see that path forward. Right. What's my next big thing? What's my next big app that I'm going to build if I happen to be a mobile developer and not a catch-all tech in a box? You know, and I think that this is especially compounded when you look at, you know, the vast apparatus of creating public media, right, over the last 40 years and the relative infancy, right, of these digital efforts. You know, where historically someone might be in the same position for 5, 10, 15 years, and a millennial comes to you as a manager after 6 months or a year and says, hey, ready, you know, give me a title change, want more money, right? That's a huge issue, and it, like everything here, it cuts both ways, right? Part of that comes down to you know, a lack of understanding on our part, not being, right, not having had the same position for 5, 10, 15 years, don't, you know, understand necessarily how those processes work, right? And so that's a communication issue that we can all sort of work together on. You know, historically, I think in public radio, it's there was an interesting progression, right, from, you know, maybe intern to reporter to program producer to, you know, program director, news director.
Special correspondent is where you
Special
end up.
Yeah. Right, over the course of a career, right? Whereas, you know, as quickly as technology and digital is evolving, you know, our expectations tend to be condensed. And it, I mean, it's a big thing, and I don't necessarily know what the answer is, but it's a, you know.
Well, all three of you are actually examples of this slide, because you were in public media, and for whatever reasons, you either got impatient, frustrated, yep, or blocked, and said, I'm going somewhere else where I can do something else. Is that right? You're looking for a more creative, responsive workplace. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
And that was my career path, too. So I was in public radio and public media for quite a while, and I left. I was producing Marketplace, and frankly, after year eight, you're still producing Marketplace every day, and it gets a little dull. And so I just got out, and I went to AOL. So it completely changed, and I did something similar. So instead of following up one career ladder, which I think most boomers are used to, so I think of my dad, 35 years at DuPont, and he got three promotions. And so it's common to just jump to a different parallel ladder and keep going back and forth. And we experienced this at PRX, and Carrie in the front row, I mean, we have real challenges managing the expectations of younger, ambitious, and highly talented staff, and how you keep them engaged and yet keep the organization rolling. So it's got to be a very rewarding and more than just money. And I think that's one of the things that is a real, real challenge for us to do.
And that was a continuing, you know, as we were putting this panel together, you know, as we talk about the different reasons how, you know, over the last year all of us have left public media, you know, I don't think any one of us would have said it was the money that was why we left, right? It comes down to a lot of the creativity, the, you know, the talent management, which I can only imagine is a huge management conundrum, like you said, that requires a lot of forethought and creative solutioning, if you will.
And complaining over beer, too.
And this is our final slide, but it actually stems from that last issue, is that we're actually facing, like, a tremendous gap now, where we have, like, a lot of, like, millennials, you know, who are now actually, you know, is leaving at public media. And that's a big problem. And it's not just, I think, technical, you know, it's talent. I've spoken with, like, a lot of people in actually journalism, too, who are very frustrated and, you know, walking away. And that's a big, big, you know, problem, especially as, you know, as boomers are, I mean, again, like, nearing nearly retirement age, to have, you know, someone they can, like, hand this off to. So I think there's a big issue, like, emerging there, with, I think, like, retaining talent and figuring out, like, what is necessary, to actually do that.
Well, you know, what we're going to end up, are we just going to end up hiring all those really good talented people who are at newspapers? What's the talent gap? There's a lot of bodies out there.
If you want, because they've been doing so well. You know,
sarcasm, again.
Yeah, sarcasm. You know, I mean, I think it's that it's not just that they're actually because it's really not like a journalism like problem, right? It's also that we need to be like competing for the best designers and the best, it's, I think, developers and strategists and all of this stuff, and there are just, I mean, you know, there's just, like, a lot of options out there. Like, people can go and I mean, like, start their own, you know, as company. And, like, a lot of, like, millennials are, like, being, you know, it's frustrated, like, by, like, sort of, like, a traditional path. They just kind of set off on their own, which has, I mean, like, a lot of challenges as well, obviously. You know, but that's an option. I think like that's always open too. So to really make public media like a place that the people want to be is an important, I think, challenge actually moving forward.
Right. That was a boomer, by the way.
That's what I was thinking.
You know, I think that if you work in public media, how hard has it been for you to find qualified developers?
Hard.
Very, very difficult. And that's just one part of the talent gap that we're struggling to address. So it's a competitive landscape. But the other one is that as we move forward, public media is under a legitimate pressure to better diversify. And as Gary Nell, the new president of CEO of NPR, has pointed out, diversity across geography, age, skill level, experience, and race is really, really important. Those are going to be touchstone values for us going forward. So trying to hit these different metrics, right, in the box and being able to fill talent gaps as boomers retire is really challenging. And the other question I have is whether boomers really understand where to find talent.
Yeah.
It's kind of remarkable when you go around, and the fact is that I think boomers tend to hire people who are much like themselves. That may be a human component, but we tend to hire folks that we're comfortable with.
And I've had the problem where I've had like a developer, you know, that I've hired that was really good. I, you know, it's have to explain like why we just can't like pay them like $15 an hour, right? I mean, like, you know, because they can go anywhere and make, you know, I mean, it's like a lot more. So we really have to make them feel like the mission is actually like really important. Also, you know, I think to them, or else I don't know that we can always actually compete on like salary, like for the best, you know, talent,
right,
either.
So
there's a big issue there.
So let's move on to the last one, and it's the one I want each of you to answer just very quickly because I want to get to questions. But what would make you return? You left. How do we get you back? D?
I think the mentorship thing is number one. Again, for me to come back, I'm going to need that, want it, and I'm probably going to look for that before I even try to go back. And then, number two, I think, is that tech in a box. If you're going to hire me and make me do 15,000 different tech things, probably not interested in that. But I would love, you know, I think that's the thing. I think that it was difficult to leave because we love public media. But at some point, you have to weigh that with what's happening. So,
okay. Adam.
I would second, I think mentorship is like a huge one. I think that also seeing like a career like path is, I mean, like another thing. I mean, like a lot of us kind of topped out in the sort of middle management roles. So there's that. And then it's also, I just want a big fat problem to solve, right? I mean, like that's really the like largest, you know, I mean, thing like for me is I like to work on really difficult, hard, you know, it's complicated things.
Right, so. Not the printer.
Right. Not the printer.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Jonathan, how about you?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it, I of course agree with everything these folks have said. And I think more specifically, you know, working on those new and different problem sets, right? If I've been spending, you know, several years trying to figure out how to get stations to talk to each other, and we've made progress and then we failed, which we, of course, is very glamorous. but then we don't see that forward progression, right? I want to see, at this point, I want to see public media do some of these strides without me, right? Show that some of the work that all of us have done and all of the pockets of really strong innovation, really strong talent, and there is very strong talent, there's a ton of innovation, a lot of excellent stuff going on in public media. I want to see that grow and evolve, you know, and then I want to come in and help solve new and different problems on top of that.
Great. Great. Well, good. How about some questions? And just a quick round of applause for these guys.
And for our fabulous moderator.
Saving us at the last minute.
Hi, Josh.
Hey. This is great. Thanks for doing this. I want to bring up the issue of Gen Xers.
I retweeted you.
Yeah.
Because that's a good question.
We've seen this problem before, and most of Gen X talent, especially at the station level, John, maybe you can, is gone already. One thing about the economy, you know, when we saw for the first time public media have layoffs, it was the middle management. It was Gen Xers that, and some of us have been able to scrape together independent careers. But now you've got boomers, 50 and over, managing millennials, 30 and under, with nothing in between. How has that exaggerated that, and what does it mean for this discussion?
Well, I suppose, speaking as Vivian Schiller, I guess I would say that, yeah, there was a huge investment made in a lot of Gen Xers, and they did rise up to a middle management position. So, and now they're gone. And I guess the last question to me was the most important one. It's like, how do we get you back? So as stations begin to stabilize, you see more fundraisers at stations actually being very successful. And I think we're going to successfully navigate whatever cuts are coming in public funding. There's going to be opportunities. And so who will stations decide to hire? Will they decide to hire the folks who've been laid off by newspapers who were just drooling to have because they've got Pulitzer Prizes? Or are we going to go back to Gen X people who've had the experience in public media and find a way to bring them back in? I can't speak for stations, but I think this is a really surprising issue that you invest all this time in a whole layer of people, get them familiar and trained and prepared to lead public media, and then, yeah, 5 or 10 years ago, they've been laid off. The only talent out there is just not newspaper talent. And I have a lot of respect for newspapers, but what's happening in public media is a much broader talent pool and need for skills. So, hi, Stacey.
Hi. So my question, you guys are talking a lot about internal processes and, you know, working in public media. My question is about content. I'm curious about how much you listen to public radio, how much you watch public television, and what is missing on the air that might entertain or engage you.
I mean, there's definitely a gap, right? I love a lot of programs on, you know, public radio and on public television, but I think I'm probably a little bit of an outlier for my age group in that regard, right? When I ask my friends, all right, what they listen to in the car every morning when they're going to work, when I, you know, talk to people, you know, oh yeah, they love Downton Abbey, but man, you know, how long has it been since you've watched, name any other program, right?
Lawrence Welk.
Yeah. Lawrence Welk included. Exactly. So yeah, I mean, content, and a lot of it gets back to the talent, right? If you're going to attract and retain the, you know, the content producers and creators, the makers, right? We're talking largely about technology makers here, but there's the whole other side of it, which is the storytelling, right? And that's where all of our roots are ultimately in how this system works.
And there's all kinds of I think, you know, innovation in audio and innovation in like video that is, I mean, still, you know, really possible and untouched. I think that we, in general, you know, I think public media like plays it kind of safe on air, and I think there's, you know, a tremendous opportunity there. And we, you know, it's do need to I think create opportunity like for that, you know, to actually be, like, not just play on the web, you know, it's but to actually make it on the radio and make it on TV. So.
Yeah, I think really just for me, you know, I think people in public media talk a lot about those driveway moments, right? Where you just can't get out of your car because what you're listening to on the radio is just so amazing. The best piece I ever heard was on PRX, and it was called Penguin Goes A-Courting, and it's a story about when the penguin and Mary Poppins get set up on a date by a mutual friend at a dinner party. And those are the kinds of things that bring us back to public media. I mean, there's a lot, but that to me was kind of a minority piece. I mean, it wasn't very, you know, minority in the sense of not, you know, it's just... There's more than diversity in the traditional sense, which I definitely think is missing. That would keep me coming back, number one. But I think there's also pockets of culture from a minority standpoint that are not explored in public media. There are topics we don't talk about that, to me, are really relevant. And that's what I'm looking for.
I would also suggest that, again, CPB has made some really impressive investments to cue along creativity and also the integration of media. So local journalism centers, almost everybody there is tasked with doing much more than just radio or much more than just video. It's you have some incredible slideshows and broader projects involving multiple media. And then another place to look is Michigan Radio. Here is a very, very traditional news operation that has invested heavily in cross-training of staff to get them adept at not just thinking about radio pieces, but something much more engaging. So there, you see pockets of change, but it's not as widespread as we would hope. So we have a few time for a couple more questions. Go ahead.
Hi, speaking of internal collaboration, information and sharing, et cetera, how many of you all use internal social networks to collaborate?
We do at PRX. So,
We did not.
Yeah, we did.
Just wondering about that. We use, I'm with AARP, we use Yammer, and it's at Yammer here at the conference, by the way. And that really seems to have opened up a lot of possibilities for collaborating, information sharing, and some other people have gotten on Yammer, have actually decided, okay, well, if I can do this, you know, maybe Twitter isn't so bad.
It's a scary right. way. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. It's a start. It's a starter drug. That's good. That's
it's a gateway drug to tweeting.
Great. Great. Yes, two quick ones, and then we're going to have to wrap it up.
I'm Leah from the NewsHour, and I was wondering where you ended up, Dell or wherever, did you find in those cultures what you were looking for? Can you talk about the pros and the cons about what you found that kind of informed maybe this discussion? Did you find your mentor? I mean, what is it like in these, you know, the places that you found?
Like that was, I mean, that was one of the almost unexpected surprises, because making any big change is going to be difficult. And I know specifically in what I'm doing at Dell now, yeah, absolutely. And there are, you know, I found, you know, when I started there, I found both formal as well as informal programs that, you know, attempt to try to accomplish these things, whether it's mentorship, whether it's career progression, you know, internal collaboration. There are these apparatuses out there. And I know that there are pockets in public media doing this as well. And I think the big story here is, you know, how do we get that more widespread? Because things do, I've seen it work.
Okay. I'm going to move on. I'm going to keep it going because we have two more minutes.
All right. What's your advice to those thinking about getting into or out of public media?
I mean, I do have to say, we are talking about public media because we didn't want this to be conceptual out in the ether. I mean, we're looking at this as a specific industry to talk about. I think this is more of sort of like a cultural zeitgeist professional problem that's happening right now. It's certainly not the only industry this is happening in. So I think, you know, in a general sense, my advice would be, and this will sort of answer the last question too, is go for where you're going to be doing the work that you want to do. You know, I mean, what is that problem that you want to work on? And go there. I wouldn't necessarily be seduced by the idea of being in an industry because that sounds amazing. I would go where the work that you want to do is. And that may be public media, it may not, depending on where you are. But that, yeah, and wear that outfit.
I can give you a quick piece of advice. One is listen and watch and find what you like in terms of the product. What looks great. Absolutely. If it looks great, people there are probably doing some pretty great things internally, right? The second one is ask around, certainly at this conference. I mean, we know where all the bodies are buried. We know the good stations and the bad stations, blah, blah, blah. Do that kind of homework. And then the other one is always you're hiring your boss. They're not hiring you. You are making selections. So when they said mentor, that's what you're looking for in that interview. What are the signals you're getting? Are they going to stick with you? Are they going to back you up? Are they going to guide you? Are they going to recognize your talent from the first moment that you sit in that room? And what is that relationship? What are you sensing about that relationship? But there are some really creative places in public media to work, but you want to pick wisely. But it's not too hard to do.
Thank you.
Okay, last question. Jessica.
Hello. I've been involved in a lot of the efforts to network the new generation of public media makers, and now I'm at the Association of Independents in Radio, which does have a mentorship program where we are trying to do a bit of a new network for people. And I say that if there's a little bit of money that anybody has, which is always a crapshoot, that finding ways to network transmedia and developing staff is the next big step.
AIR's mentorship program is one of the longest lasting. It's one of the broadest in terms of attracting mentors, and it does go very far in creating relationships between boomers and more senior practitioners and younger emerging producers and practitioners in public radio. I've been a mentor, and it was a hugely valuable experience, and I got a lot back in terms of understanding the problems that a millennial generation is facing, trying to adapt how they work and their vision into what can be a kind of a confounding structure. So AIR is a really great place to go. Go to airmedia.org. Thank you very much. This was great.
Thank you.